as many prominent commentators, particularly on the right, talked about them in terms of pure criminality.
Yeah.
It seems there's a deficit of sociological imagination at work here.
Yes, well, the first lesson that any serious encounter with sociological ideas, particularly in relation to the issue of criminality, is that such a thing as pure criminality doesn't exist. Criminality always takes place in a context which is social, political, and economic. Basic principle, sociology 101, you know. And in a sense, that reveals, I think you're quite right, the profound deficit of sociological imagination amongst the public commentators at the time. You know, that was so... And it was more than that, actually. It was more than just a deficit of imagination. It was a kind of active refusal of any kind of engagement with the context in which these events had taken place.
An attempt to shut down discussion along those lines.
I mean, you remember Boris Johnson, what he said, you know, at the time. He didn't want any nonsense, as he referred to it, and talk about deep sociological justifications. Now, you know, the important thing that I think he misses, and maybe they do it willfully, maybe they don't do it, you know, as a kind of, as an accident of political common sense, they do it willfully, but is to conflate justification with understanding and explanation. You know, that what he, I think, was trying to foreclose was any serious understanding of the social forces that were at play in the midst of those events. You know, it was about judging, condoning, judging and condemning. It's almost a kind of textbook moral panic, I think, in that sense. You know.
Does it reveal something? potentially dangerous to establish power about the sociological imagination?
Well, you see, I think this is a very good question. It's dangerous in the sense that power and elites can sort of push away the prospect of understanding or thinking critically about the social forces that are at play in any contemporary public issue. It's dangerous in that sense. But also, it needs to be said that Mills, remember, in his wonderful book, Sociological Imagination, which your kind of site is, I think, a best illustration of the contemporary relevance and the sort of vitality of that idea. He says, you know, that the sociological imagination isn't confined to the discipline of sociology, that it proliferates. It becomes a kind of vernacular. Now, most people, I think, on broadly the left, welcome the potential for a kind of popular vernacular sociology. The excitement, for example, around things like The Wire, and the sort of quite imperious way in which some of my favourite sociologists like Howie Becker try to absorb all kinds of writers, thinkers, into a sociological canon, you know, from Jane Austen. Well, he's particularly promiscuous in the way he wants to enlist photographers, novelists as sociologists. Okay. So usually that idea of a vernacular or the spreading of the sociological imagination is thought of as being potentially a kind of popular leftist, left-leaning energy or current. But it's equally true to say that the sociological imagination has spread to less comfortable places. You know, in the training of the immigration service and immigration officers, you know, in the way that it kind of permeates the institutions of state power. You know, one of the things that I constantly go back to in my own mind was a sense of shock that I had some years ago in the midst of an inquiry to the experience of users in the Immigration Service. What was the Immigration and Nationality Directorate in Croydon in those days? It was when a very senior immigration officer said, well, you know, what we're trying to do, we're just trying to find the right kind of context in which we can facilitate the asylum narrative. And the sort of language of a methodology seminar was suddenly inside the machine of people flow and people control.
Which is perverse, but fascinatingly so.
Exactly. So I think it's unstable, that's my point. But I think in the case of of the Summers offence, there was a sort of willful refusal to engage within any kind of product of understanding or contextualization, and also the kind of moral suspicion with regard to the motives of anybody who said, well, hold on a minute, you know, what's the relationship between the fact that, you know, if you're young now in some parts of London, you're, and if and from some kind of cultural legacies and backgrounds, you know, black young men, 50% levels of unemployment, 10 years ago that was 1 in 10, you know, 1 in 2 to 1 in 10, what kind of factor does that play in the midst of it? It was almost like, that's justification, that's moral cowardice. So I think, yes, it was definitely one of the things that was so damaging. And also the fact that there were so few spaces publicly to have that kind of conversation and argument. It was almost like that was shut down, the potential for that argument.
And what about the police at the time? Because, I mean, they were widely criticised for their allegedly hands-off approach to the riots, particularly in the earlier stages, in the first day or two. How do you think this ties into the wider discourse of public order policing, particularly in terms of protest and politics? And I'm thinking here of the student protests in particular.
Well, I think it's too soon to know, to be absolutely honest with you, what was going on there. But there are a few things that occurred to me in the midst of all of those events. Was, yes, there was a degree to which the police pulled back. Didn't mean they weren't watching and listening very attentively. Very attentively. They were surveying the scene, maybe not getting involved in the conflict, but pulling back. But, you know, it needs to be also remembered, but they'd been very much hands-on in the period leading up to those events. You know, the phenomenal increase of stop and search of young people, particularly young black people. Phenomenal. You know, I'm trying to remember the exact figures now. Oh, that's right, yeah, 1993, if you were young black male, you were 5 times more likely to be stopped by the police than if you were a white young male. In 2010, you know, black young men were 26 times more likely than white people to be stopped and searched. You know, that's a phenomenal hands-on approach to policing, you know, in the midst of the kind of the concerns about securitization and of violence, gang so-called, you know, peer violence and so on. So, you know, yes, it's true that the police withdrew while the cameras were rolling and while they were paying close attention. The CCTV was rolling, I should say. But, you know, in the lead up to those events, there'd been profound hands-on approach to the policing of young people in those contexts. You know, so I think that's very much part of what we've seen. And then in the aftermath of that, an extraordinary fevered condemnation, blame, prosecution, and I would go as far to say persecution of young people in the midst of, as a kind of, you know, a folk demon that could be the mechanism through which the crisis could be policed as well as the streets, the crisis that was going on, you know, more broadly, economically and politically.
Because I was thinking at the time about the way in which the whole chain of events, and I was very conscious of no longer living in London, which I think shaped my perspective a lot.
Yeah.
But everything seemed surreal.
Yeah.
It seemed surreal throughout, and even the ramifications afterwards, and, you know, this, I think it's fair to say, persecution, seemed surreal in its scope and its intensity.
Yeah.
It was almost like there was a national psychodrama
playing
out in vivid imagery.
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think it's too strong to put it that in those terms. I don't think it's too strong at all to put it in those terms. You know, and that's not to justify what happened and the violence. But it's quite something different to try and understand those events rather than just to use understanding as, you know, as a code, if you like, for justification, which is what people in the political class were doing across the spectrum, you know. Yeah, and there's such a tremendous poverty of imagination there. And I think it was kind of surreal too. for lots of reasons. One of the things I thought was really interesting about these moments of unrest, and I'm trying to think of another moment that was like it, was the degree to which the participants in the midst of those events also had their own devices to observe and record what was going on. It wasn't just that the CCTV was working over time. No, you had a kind of situated observation by people who were inside and proximate to the events, and then broadcasting that. One of the most interesting and telling YouTube videos that I watched around the time is, and as you say, this is kind of slightly surreal, a YouTube posting from a scene literally at the end of the street that I live in Catford in South London. There's a little sort of roundabout area in the central part of this district of South London. There's a JD Sports, there's a McDonald's, there's an Aldi, you know, or a Lidl, I should say, a Lidl. And this young man standing in front of the JD Sports with his smartphone is recording the youths, very young some, and then older people going in and out carrying boxes of trainers, you know. And the thing that really caught my imagination was that it's not only that he's standing there with his smartphone recording it, he's also giving a kind of running commentary. And a friend of his comes up to talk to him, and she says, "God, I can't believe how young these kids are going in there." And she asks him if he's tempted to go in and grab a couple of pairs of trainers, you know. And he said, "Yeah, I'd love to go in there, but, you know, I'm a working man. I'm a working man, and I can't afford to go in there," basically. And then she says, two young black Londoners, she says, "Well, you know, I work in a nursery locally, and my criminal records bureau check is very precious to me, and I need to preserve that, so I'm not going in there either." I don't think she had any inclination to go in there, or was it any temptation. But it felt like to me, in that one small moment, there was a line being drawn between those people who had something to lose, you know, and those people whose future was less valuable than a couple of pairs of Nike trainers.
Because one thing that struck me time and time again in some of these videos was people's awareness that they were being filmed, and yet nonetheless they made no attempt to disguise their identity. And I can't help but read that through a filter of my own perspective on the world. Is it that they felt they didn't have anything to lose? Did they just not think about the fact they were being filmed? Or
well, that I'm sure there's some of that at play. I think there's some of that at play. You know, maybe this also explains why the police withdrew. You know, although they were biding their time. I think as well there's another aspect to this, which is the idea that you are broadcasting yourself has become so kind of banal. We're doing it now, in our culture. You know, YouTube, what's their that's their byline. Self-broadcast, Facebook the same. So in a way, the democratization of media brings with it that kind of unprecedented level of self-broadcast, and maybe even self-revelation.
Capturing the act,
capturing yourself, you know, and is that a democratic force? Or does it have another kind of side, which is, you know, self-organized surveillance, you know, revelation, exposure?
It'd be interesting to know actually to what extent these films were used in prosecutions.
Yes, it would. I would be really keen
because
to know that.
In that light, it becomes, I completely take your point, it hadn't occurred, it becomes very panoptical, doesn't it?
It does, certainly, yeah, it does. I bet the police were using them. I don't know for sure, but my hunch would be that I bet they do.
Let's stand off and watch people incriminate themselves.
Partly. Well, the alternative is an intervention in the massive conflict. You know, and you know, there was it wasn't just about exposure and people being kind of, it's this kind of version of the panopticon, as you say, a kind of, you know, online prison, you know, in which you're constantly being invited to reveal and show. But there's another part of this too, I think, which is interesting, that in that there are small banal moments that kind of come in and out of camera in some of those YouTube broadcasts. Another one of my sort of ones that caught my imagination was a scene of a shop in Peckham that had the windows smashed, and you could tell that the sentiment of the crowd was getting angry. There were two or three young men, particularly one starts to light. It was a clothing shop. One starts to light a blouse or a top or something, throws it into the shop, and then you see. You can see the fire is catching in the background of the footage, and then this very kind of elderly man with long grey dreadlocks, with a small carrier bag. He's obviously just been to the takeaway shop to get his tea, you know, whatever he's got in there, a couple of boxes of food. You're walking along, comes past. And he sees the flames catching, puts his lunch down, or his dinner, or his tea, whatever, goes in the shop, grabs all of the garments, including the ones that are burning, throws them in the street, goes out, picks up his bag of takeaway, carries on.
Continues with his day.
Yeah, he's probably, you know, totally transformed in that one action.
Mm.
You know, small, brave, hopeful gesture. You know, I think that one of the things that is terrifying in the context of those kinds of events is fire, actually. And it shouldn't be minimised.
I remember on the day when things started, and that was the point at which I realised the severity of events. I woke up early on Sunday morning, and it was, at that point, I admit, just a very interesting news story.
Mm.
And then it was the realisation that someone's home had been burnt out.
Yeah.
I realised it was something... It was big, it was severe,
yeah,
and dramatic.
No, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, what role do you think social media played in the organising of the riots? Do you think it overstates the degree to which they were organised?
I don't think we know yet. Social media certainly played some part, you know, it depends how broadly we think of that term, but yeah, of course, you know, of course social media plays a role. But I think the talk about it has been somewhat overplayed, you know, and the sort of public concern about it, I think, has been overemphasized.
As prominent politicians called for Twitter to be shut down.
Exactly. My experience, and it might be very localized, you know, from what I saw and what I was witnessing, was that these weren't kind of thousands of young people swarming from all parts of the southeast. You know, that's what, again, is kind of challenging by looking at the YouTube footage, is how familiar those young people's faces are, how much they are. They're just local kids, actually, in large part.
I was struck by the thought there was something almost carnivalesque about it, that people get drawn out because there's a sense, and, you know, the media coverage amplifies everything, and the normal order of things becomes inverted.
Yeah. Well, you see, I think that's it's important not to see these events as exceptional. You know, that was the case in 1985. It was the case in 1981. You know, I think that is often the case, that the moment of riot, so called, is also a moment of the carnivalesque. You know, of the suspension of the normal terms. And also of the suspension of the normal rhythms of life, you know. But I think that also opens up a tougher question for us to think about: is, well, what happens when that occurs? What happens?
The state has to reassert itself.
Well, the state initially withdraws. You know, the state withdraws. Now, for the participants in the midst of that, it's a moment when, in a sense, a moment of freedom. You know, what do you do when the rule of law withdraws? And I think one of the difficult things, in the midst of all of the police harassment that was going on, the escalation of stop and search, the austere economic situation, the burgeoning youth unemployment, the question remains, well, what do you do at the moment when you're most free? Do you go shopping? You know, and in a sense, I thought, Zygmunt, we're making this recording here in Leeds, and one of the pieces that I thought was the most sort of thought-provoking was something that Zygmunt Bauman wrote at the time, when he talked about how these were, I'm just trying to remember the precise phrasing of what he said, actually. He talked about them as, oh, that's right, as rights of disqualified consumers. I thought, God, that's an interesting thought, you know, disqualified consumers. And the degree to which, I suppose, consumerism, consumer capitalism, has, my implication, and the implication of what I took from what he was saying, was that it kind of colonised, in a sense, the political imagination of those groups of young people out on the street, you know, taxing the system, getting paid, you know.
Jock Jung has a concept which he calls cultural bulimia, which he developed in the context of making sense of the Leeds and Bradford riots. The idea that on the one hand there's cultural inclusion, you're sold a promise of being part of this great capitalist dream, and the structural exclusion, you know, people are drawn in and then spat out again.
Exactly. I think that's, and you know, in societies where the other part of Bauman's contribution to the debate, which I thought was really, as I say, really thoughtful and inspiring, is that he said, you know, what happens, or he argued that societies that produce profound forms of division and inequality don't always produce revolutionary moves or revolutionary mobilizations, but what they do produce are societies that are kind of societies in which the kind of social and cultural landscape is littered with mines. They become minefields, and you never quite know when you're going to step on a mine, when it's going to go off. And I thought, gosh, that's an interesting thought, you know, that those patterns of polarisation and inequality, and at that time too, you know, the beginnings of what we've come to call austerity, it was one of those moments where someone stepped on a mine and it exploded.
But do you think there are lessons we can learn from this? Because although I see the appeal of that sort of mine metaphor, it's also a little bit depressing at the same time.
Yeah.
Because you can't know where they are.
No, you can't know
if they're mines that have been used effectively.
Yes, that's right. I mean, but the thing is that we do know where they are, often. You know, I mean, I think the geography of those forms of unrest surprised many people, actually, particularly how far it reached into the suburbs of South London, particularly. But actually, when you think about it more carefully, it's completely understandable and comprehensible.
Particularly given the strange social geography of many parts of London, where you have such extreme wealth and poverty side by side.
Side by side, cheek by jowl, absolutely, I think that's right. So in a sense, we do know where the mines are, or if you like, or where the extreme forms of inequality produce that potential for flashpoints. So, I mean, I think the other thing that is important in the midst of this is to be able to have an open conversation with young people, actually, specifically young people, about how they understood those events, what they made of them, you know, what they make of their relationship to the police and to the criminal justice system. You know, I think that's another really important thing, which I think the conversations that I've been part of or been involved with in those sorts of forums, it's always been really surprising, and I learned a lot from. Well, where was young people's voice in all of that? They had a few kids in hoodies that news teams would find the absolutely kind of cliched stories from and broadcast them, but no serious engagement, reflection, dialogue with those young people whose lives in many respects have been the ones that have been most intensely affected by the economic and political context. Something about the relationship to the criminal justice system and the relationship between that and our understanding of what society is, and the danger that we're moving towards a situation where, you know, society becomes modelled on the structure of the prison. You know, some of the work that I think is really important that I've certainly learned a lot from that sort of talks about those kinds of questions, focuses on the emergence of the sort of super maximum prison in America. And there's a sort of reformer, an abolitionist there called Craig Haney, who I think is a really interesting person, and he argues that what's emerging is a new kind of social order where people are divided into effectively three groups. There's, on the one hand, a prison class, people who are intermittently spending time in a network of prisons. There's a class of jailers who oversee those prisons. And then there's a kind of a class of professional and legal administrative elites, which you could stretch to include everyone from, you know, a solicitor to a probation officer to a health visitor to a local GP, who decide in which of the previous two categories, the jailers or the prisoners, the rest of us get put, which is a kind of dystopian image of the future, or vision of the future. But you know, I remember speaking to a young man just after the riots who was saying, well, you know, for so many of us now, spending periods of time in prison, it's no big deal, you know. You get to watch the telly, you know, it's so what, you spend 6 months inside. And it makes that kind of choice, the choice that the young people were being confronted with in front of JD Sports, have a different kind of quality, I think.
So it's not just jail, it's an occupational hazard, it's something beyond that, just part of the normal cycle of life.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I fear, actually. That, you know, very large numbers of young people are going to kind of be channeled into that kind of cycle of life. You know, maybe they're already. You know, I think that's a real risk.
Mm.
You know, it's a real risk in our time and in the immediate future.